watts per square meter. But the units that we need is per square centimeter. It's 10,000 square centimeters per square meter. 100 centimeters per meter, 100 squared is 10,000, so 10,000 to 1 ratio. Therefore, when you do this experiment, you're receiving 384 milliwatts. You know the area of your receiving dipole. To calculate that out, you've got 0.07 milliwatts per square centimeter. That experiment, 0.07 milliwatts per square centimeter. Let me drop. In my mind, and there you're going to disagree with me a little bit maybe, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is the real threshold of consideration. It's already got a 10 to 1 safety factor built into it, compared to that clamped down rabbit experiment that was done. And by the way, lots of other animals have been used in later experiments to confirm this. No human being would tolerate that. He would move out of the way. He wouldn't sit there holding his eye open for 6 solid minutes with a key down transmitter looking into it. So for a whole bunch of reasons, it's a severe requirement of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. But you're going to measure in that experiment, 10 feet away, 0.07 milliwatts per square centimeter. That is a safety factor of 143 to 1. The power you would absorb if you put your eye directly above that dipole that's doing the receiving 10 feet away, by my definition of the safety factor, you have 143 to 1 safety factor. Your next question would be, hey, I'm not going to do this 10 feet away. I'm going to start moving in closer. Where do I exceed the number 10 milliwatts per square centimeter? Let me drop. And the answer, you would exceed it at 8/10 of a foot, 10 inches. If your eye was 10 inches away from the transmitting dipole, the calculated number you would get is 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, the threshold of alarm. Who in the world would put his eye 10 inches away from a dipole, stare into it for 6 solid minutes with the transmitter running 50 watts, key down for 6 solid minutes? Nobody in his right mind would do that. The heat you would feel on your face, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, 100 watts per square meter, you would feel the heat on your face after a couple of minutes, and you'd say, gee, I don't want to stay here. And you'd be blinking, you'd be doing all kinds of things to make it a lot safer than it seems. There's one other factor here to worry about. Could you really calculate what happens at 10 inches? And the answer is not quite. Let me drop. Every antenna has something called a calculated near field range. One of the major used definitions of near field range is 2 d squared over lambda. If it's a horn or a parabolic dish, for instance, where you really know the diameter of the receiving area, you square it, multiply by 2, divide it by wavelength, that gives you a certain range in which, if you're beyond that range, you can measure the E field, you can measure the gain, you can measure the pattern, you make measurements of the antenna that are traceable to the Bureau. When you get closer than the near field range, when you're inside of the near field range, your so-called reactive near field range, the capacitive coupling directly from the tips of the dipole into your instrumentation will give you numbers that are beyond inverse square law. Let me drop. Let's assume now I've got a sensitive receiving apparatus, and whether the receiving apparatus is calculated in milliwatts per square centimeter, volts per meter, no matter what units it is, I start off a couple of miles away, and I start moving toward the transmitting antenna. For the majority of my movement, I will obey inverse square law. Every time I half the distance, I get 4 times the amount of power. 6 dB increase every time I half the distance. Or you could call it 6 dB more loss if I move away. So I keep moving toward the antenna. Every time I half the distance, I get 4 times more power. When I start getting into the near field range, it doesn't obey inverse square law anymore. It starts going to inverse third, fourth, fifth law, because you're getting direct capacitive coupling effects and direct inductive coupling effects. So when you get real close to an antenna, where that signal coming out of the antenna is it's really a signal bouncing back and forth on the wire. It's got a whole lot of local current making magnetic field. It's got a whole lot of voltages on the tips making local voltages. So when you're real close to that dipole in this case, you start measuring voltages and currents and magnetic fields that are beyond the inverse square law. If you also try to make measurements directly of the antenna pattern that close, you'd come up with crazy numbers. numbers. Let me drop. So the antenna mavens make sure when they set up their antenna testing range, they make sure that the antenna under test is being tested at a range greater than the near field range, in which case they can directly evaluate pattern, gain, power output, power flux density, all of that. There are methods by which you can take the predictable mathematics and make measurements in the near field range, but it's not a direct measurement anymore. You got to use a whole lot of calibrating factors, so to speak. So this, you can see that the instrumentation required for you to do a direct confirmation with ham radio equipment, a pair of dipoles, your 50 watt transmitter, and your ruler, so to speak, to establish 10 feet for the particular measurement, or the 1 foot. By the way, I should have told you that the near field range of a dipole on 2 meters is somewhere around 2 feet, 2.2 feet. If you're closer than 2.2 feet to a dipole on 2 meters, you are inside of the near field range. Let me drop. You could no longer measure the pattern directly without some compensating factors. On top of that, the power you'll measure will be a slightly crazy number because it's no longer obeying inverse square law. So, very simple instrumentation. A pair of dipoles, 10 foot of range, your 50 watt transmitter. You do that measurement, you'll find out that at the location 10 feet away of your receiving dipole, your safety factor is 143 to 1 by my particular 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is, in my opinion, the real number to be used. Yeah, if the person is thoroughly uninformed, they go down to numbers like 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, in which case, instead of 143 to 1 safety factor, I forget what the safety factor turns out, something like 60 to 1. So as you can tell, whether or not you're worrying about radiating 50 watts or 51 watts, when you've got a safety factor of 143 to 1, it really is kind of academic. It's similar to a crazy statement I make, is that I'm building a house with bricks. Let me drop. Do I really have to drop every one of those bricks to make sure that gravity is going to pull on it and that each brick weighs the right number of pounds in order to build my house? I mean, if the bricks are approximately the right color, if they look like bricks, I'm likely to go and build the house. Do I really have to make that measurement? Well, in this particular case, when you have, assuming that we confirm the mathematics, there hasn't been a decimal place displacement here. And I kind of doubt that because I've been down this road a number of times over the last 30 years. But assuming that this is accurate, when you've got a safety factor more than 100 to 1, do you really have to make that measurement? I think not. Now, if you're radiating 50 watts into the dipole, or if it's 50 watts into your mag mount antenna on top of the car, if a person put himself in the vicinity of 1 foot away from that antenna on the roof of your car, you key your transmitter key down for 6 solid minutes, and he holds his eye open and stares at the antenna for the 6 solid minutes. You and I know that under those situations, you're at the threshold of alarm. The guy hasn't got a cataract yet, but if he kept doing that day in and day out, you're getting dangerously close to it. But who in the world would do that? Place himself approximately 1 foot away from an antenna on a car and stay there for 6 solid minutes without moving, even though you're starting to feel some heat on your face, while the guy is squeezing the mic for 6 solid minutes. There's quite a bit more to this situation, but I think you can see the flavor of it, Ed. And so, it's good that we discuss it, but I don't think it's something to really be alarmed about. Where did that number 50 watts come from? Let me drop it. Very similar to the number that's being used in the town of Hempstead, where you're not allowed to put a brand new cell site within 500 feet of a place of worship, a school, or a private residence. 500 feet. They hired a expert who gave them that number. He knew what they wanted to hear, and he gave them that number. The real number for a cell site, the dangerous range, is 5 feet, not 500 feet. And the very naive people in Hempstead didn't ask the question of the expert, where did that number come from? Did it come from the American National Standards Institute C95 report? Absolutely not. And that is the defining document for the United States. It's used by the Department of Defense, NIOSH, OSHA. Everybody uses that document. There's a very similar document in each one of the major developed nations around the world. There's a similar document for Europe and for Asia and so on. And the numbers all hang together. So the real dangerous range is 5.0 feet. So in the case of ham radio operations, very few of us are doing anything that is dangerous. But would you like to hear about a dangerous situation? The most dangerous situation I know of. Let me drop. Occurred on Kwajalein Island during World War II. There was a 150-foot diameter dish with 10 megawatts of power going into it. And how close could those personnel on Kwajalein Island with their living quarters, how close could the living quarters be to that dish in order to be safe? 10 million watts peak envelope power of this over-the-horizon radar on Kwajalein Island, 150-foot dish. I went through the mathematics of that because W4RX, Jim Algren, went on to the microwave reflector about 4 years ago and asked that question. And I answered the question. You could read the answer to that question by going to the website of amateurradio.tangovictor and look at the article supplied by K2RIW, and you will read that article. And I didn't answer it with a whole bunch of mathematics. I did it in a step-by-step process so that you could easily read it and see what's going on. Let me drop it. I calculated how many watts is being radiated, what's the gain of the antenna, what's the duty factor of the transmissions. It turns out that the heating factor for RF energy is not a function of what is peak envelope power, what is the average power. That's what creates heating. The fact that you're putting out pulses of 10 microseconds long each, but you're only putting out 300 of them per second, means that your total radiated power is a hell of a lot less than 10 megawatts. On top of that, this antenna, 150-foot in diameter, is smearing that energy over an acre of property, so to speak, and a human being standing in front of that antenna, a human being has roughly 1/2 square meter of area, and that dish has hundreds of square meters. So the vast majority of the energy coming out of the dish misses you when you're standing in front of it. The higher the gain the antenna, the safer it is when you're up close. Opposite of common sense. So, you can read that article, and you'll get some more of the flavor along these lines. I think you get the essence of what I'm saying here, Joe. I mean, Ed. The number 50 watts, 50 watts, where did the FCC come up with that number? It's a darn interesting question. Because until you get to something like 500 watts into that dipole, at distances that you're likely to be located to that dipole, again, you wouldn't do it, because you would start feeling the heat on your face and you wouldn't stay there. So the vast majority of what we amateurs do is amazingly safe. KC2, PYT, K2RIW, I know you have some further questions and comments on this one, Ed. Darn good question. You got it, Ed.
All right, well, my question was motivated by moving to a new apartment, and the only real place I have to put an antenna outside is sort of close to other people's stuff. And so I was concerned that if I'm going to be pushing above that 50 watt line, that I would need to start worrying about uncontrolled exposure. And it sounds like I really don't have to worry about that, as long as I can ensure that they will keep their eyeballs at least a couple feet away from the antenna, that I'll be in pretty good shape, unless I start running an amplifier or something.
Yeah, for them to get in trouble, Ed, they'd have to be something like a foot away from your antenna, stay there for 6 solid minutes, holding their eye open for 6 minutes, even blinking your eye. The eyelid is a kind of attenuator between the RF energy and your eye. It's the cornea of the eye and the lens of the eye that, if it becomes overheated, could potentially develop a cataract. That's what they discovered with those experiments on that poor animal. And the reason the eye is is so sensitive is because you want the eye to have a lens and a cornea that is clear, and the lens and cornea of the eye is a little bit like the white, the clear portion of an egg. You heat it up, and it's not clear anymore. It's sort of a simplified explanation for how you develop a cataract. The rate of fluid flow in the eye is the one portion of the body where the rate of fluid flow is very slow. Therefore, the eye does not have a natural cooling mechanism. The blood that flows through your hand, your arm, your head, your face, the blood is moving so fast, and it's such a beautiful cooling fluid because it's primarily water, so to speak. To heat a human body to a level where it becomes uncomfortable and you potentially create damage is a lot more difficult than you would think. When you lie on the beach on a summer day, on a clear summer day, and the sun is giving you 1,300 watts per square meter, the solar flux density is around 1,300 watts per square meter. You, human being, are around a half square meter, so you're getting half of that power, something like 600 and some odd watts, 600 and some odd watts of solar power is hitting your body, and a significant percentage of that gets absorbed, and your body can tolerate that if you're not staring into the sun. You stare into the sun, and yes, you can do damage to your retina real fast, and maybe you can even do damage to...
Repeater, time out.
And maybe you could even do damage to your cornea or to your lens by staring into the sun for significant periods of time. But the human being has tolerated 1,300 watts per square meter of solar energy for lots and lots of years. And as long as you are wearing the right solar protection factor so that you don't get over sunburned, or as long as you have dark enough colored skin that gives you a natural protection, that sunlight is pretty safe. And so for RF energy, because we make the mistake of calling it radio frequency radiation, there's the problem. It's a vocabulary problem is the majority of what's going on here. Had the early guys doing radio research called it radio signaling, radio transmission, and not radio radiation, RF radiation, we wouldn't be making the mistake of comparing it to nuclear radiation. Let me drop. And nuclear radiation has some rather different phenomena by which it can do damage to a human being. All of those 60 years of research by the American National Standards Institute, C95 report, which gets updated every couple of years, that 60 years of research has shown that 99% of what RF energy does when it touches a human being is it gets a certain percentage, depending on what frequency, gets absorbed and turned into heat. So for those 60 years, they've been looking for the non-thermal effect, and I could reasonably say they haven't found it. Now, you've got to be careful how you rate that. I could take the RF energy that we consider safe, and if I do an extremely sensitive measurement where I'm measuring parts per billion, would I see a change in your chemistry at 10 milliwatts per square centimeter for 6 solid minutes? If I'm measuring your blood constituents in parts per billion, I might see a little bit of shift of your blood chemistry. And now you ask yourself, is that deleterious? Is there a way that you can find out, is that going to create some damage downrange? The fact that you can measure an effect doesn't mean it's dangerous. The safest thing in the world is clear, cool water. And there are college students every year who literally die because during the hazing process, they go through a crazy experiment in which they find out who can drink the most amount of water in some small number of minutes. And an overly enthusiastic student that drinks down tremendous amounts of water can literally die from doing that. So, I mean, the safest thing in the world, if you do it to excess, can create damage. Does that mean we should outlaw water? Of course not. And by the way, we could call water, instead of calling it... We can call it dihydrogen monooxygen. Make sure that we avoid any exposure to dihydrogen monooxygen. Or we could also call it hydrogen hydroxide. Make sure you avoid any exposure to hydrogen hydroxide because a certain number of students die by consuming the stuff per year. So that's a crazy thing. I mean, people who don't understand human physiology do that kind of hazing, and somebody has got to transmit the message that you got to stop doing that. It's too dangerous, even though you think it's safe. I mean, we all know that if you take a large amount of alcohol in a short period of time, you can create alcohol poisoning, and if you don't throw it back up, you might die from that. Well, even simple water can get you in trouble. So RF energy is nowhere near as dangerous as you think, and as you can see by reading that report in the Amateur Radio Tango Victor. Let me drop. About what was going on with this 10 megawatt huge high power radar during World War II at Kwajalein Island, and even that huge piece of hardware running extremely high power, you'd be amazed what you've got to do to get yourself in trouble even with that one. But we amateurs, for the most part, we don't deal with those kinds of powers. The most dangerous thing I can think of is standing very close to a feed horn that goes into a parabolic dish. Now you've got a high concentrator. It's not too different than looking down the rifle of a gun, if you know what I mean. So lots of watts coming into a very small diameter feed horn, and you stand very close to it, there you could push your luck. But again, very few of us are doing that experiment. And if that feed horn was going into a 28-foot diameter dish with 29 dB of gain at 432, and you stand in front of that dish, you'd be amazed how safe you are, because the energy is being spread over so many square feet. Back to you for any further questions or comments on all of the above, Ed. And after I pass it over to you, I'll open it to the group to see if they've got any further questions. But as I see it, even on 2 meters, where you can get very close to that dipole with 50 watts into it, you got to do some pretty foolish things to get yourself in trouble. KC2PYT, K2LIW in the TechNet. Government.
KC2PYT, I think that about sums it up. Thank you for walking us through the math. And I'm going to go head to bed. Have a great night. KC2PYT, clear.
Okay, Ed. Wesley, go right ahead with your comment.
UFO magnetic material, which is actually made from a number of dipoles bonded together. Now, you deliver the frequency that is the resonance frequency of the wavelength of the ferrite. Now you're causing switching domains, and now you're causing a physical vibration, especially at very low frequencies. That's your interaction of electromagnetic wave in close proximity, in close field, in near field, to the electromagnetic material, right or wrong.
It might be right, but is that something we should be worried about? If I've got ferrite material in my hand, and I'm standing in front of a 2 meter dipole, and I'm a couple of feet away, are you suggesting I've created a dangerous condition? Is that what you're suggesting, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW.
I was asking myself the same question, Lithuania, when actually we thought that we created the precession in the electromagnetic material. That was 3 years ago when I was talking about the Army experiments with ferrites as well, with electromagnetic resonance. I'm thinking we have a direct proof of interaction that creates a motion of electromagnetic field. That's one of the interactions with matter. Interaction.
I believe a couple of years ago, Eric, Wes, you were reporting to us that in Eastern Europe, a number of guys were doing experiments with the yolk ferrite material from a television set, winding various coils on it, putting RF energy through it, and they believed they were seeing physiological effects on human beings. I think the main reason they were doing that research is looking for excess energy. In other words, they wanted to create a circuit where you put 10 watts into it and get 11 watts back out of it. They were looking for circuits hoping to do that. But in the process, I think some of the people doing the experiments believed they had some biological effects. get sick from doing that, being near that yoke material while the RF energy is applied to it. Is that approximately what we're what you're telling us about now, Wes, into XJN, K2RIW?
That is correct, and that was including me. When I came to the bench, the ferrite yoke that we believe was doped, it was one that had an extremely different crystalline structure. One of the people, the main experimenter, said he was hit with something. Say, what? He was playing with it for a while before, and he noticed that his hair, he's losing the hair, let me know. There were six people in the room, and that was me also, and we have noticed, so I said, listen, you trust your imagination, so I put my hat next to the ferrite, and nothing happened, I feel nothing, but 20-25 minutes later, I felt an extreme headache, and then the headache actually came from the forehead to the back of the head and sustained about 2.5 weeks in a very strong, being very strong after me returning from Lithuania. But what I'm saying is, in general, I agree with you completely, but there are certain situations at which we should look at interaction, that kind of interaction, different way, especially.
Yeah, we'd like to make a guess that the ferrite was doing some kind of concentrating, re-emitting. I mean, if I look at the ferrite as a kind of an antenna, at least at frequencies like 2 meters, it doesn't have anywhere near enough wavelengths of dimension. It doesn't have enough area to have a significant antenna pattern of re-radiated signal on 2 meters. So if it was RF energy going in and RF energy coming back out, it doesn't have enough size to do anything significant at, say, 2 meters or 432. So if it's not RF energy being concentrated, is it emitting something else? Well, I guess you could run some experiments with a Geiger counter or other kinds of emitter detectors, and you've got some very fancy equipment in your house. We got to find a way of telling people how to find that that YouTube video you made most recently, Wes, in which you've got some very fancy equipment in your house which is capable of doing spectral analysis of radioactive emitters and looking at the individual spectral lines and analyzing them and finding out. Let me drop. And finding out what the original material was. And you're taking apart a $100,000 instrument, so to speak, to replace a battery inside that's part of the display. And that's a real ham radio philosophy. Very few people in the commercial world will take a $100,000 instrument. I'm talking about brand new value. You obviously bought it on the surplus market, I believe. And taking it apart down to the component level and repairing things. A ham will do that. The commercial world would be afraid to do that, so it's an interesting operation you're involved in. I wish some more people could see that YouTube video to see the kind of instrumentation you've got. My guess is if all of that instrumentation in your laboratory was bought brand new, it would be a good fraction of $1 million. Am I guessing correct on that one, Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW?
That's 305.
I think you said times 3 or 5. Is that what you said?
That's correct.
Whoa. Heavy. So we've got to make an arrangement by which more people can see that YouTube video. Very significant. Unfortunately, it's kind of left of center of normal ham radio questions. Not many people listening to the TechNet are doing nuclear research. But if they were, they would enjoy your video.
I have sent some time ago, I sent it also to Dr. Roy, the compared with another device that allows betas in real time and alphas in real time. And that was actually not based on the graph, but based on the picture. Did you see that one?
I think I did. And I know that Roy and I and John got a copy of your website that shows that YouTube video. And I imagine if people took your name and do a search with YouTube. With YouTube, you can put in a search word, and it'll find YouTube videos that follow that word. So your name would allow us to find a number of those videos, I believe. The next person on the list was Eric, KE2EJ. Eric, if you're still with us, I think you had a question you wanted to ask tonight. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2IW, K2J. I returned an email to you. I just wanted to know if you got it and you had some thoughts and you wanted to say anything about it, because I haven't run into you all week.
Yes, I got your email, and you did something a little unusual. There is a way that you can use Google Earth, and you can do a bird's eye view of a particular site. You can fly around the site. The video I gave you was the typical video where north is up. And I think you gave me a video back where north is down, so to speak. And yes, you indicated where the antenna is located, where the feed line is located, where the equipment is located. And I can't think of a better location. The antenna is in what looks like an ideal location. The fact that there are other sticks nearby does not bother me. I know it bothers other people. Let me drop. If I had a whole bunch of station master antennas in a great big array on the roof of a building, and they're all, let me pick a number, 4 feet apart, common sense would lead you to believe that, boy, you're going to get a very complicated pattern out of that. Absolutely not. Another station master-like antenna at your particular operating frequency has an extremely small radar cross-section. It has very little effective reflecting area to it, so it can't disturb the pattern very much. It is 99% transparent to other frequencies. Only if the other antenna was simultaneously emitting a signal of similar power, which is coherent. Now you're making a phased array. To really steer the beam coming out of a phased array antenna. Let me drop. All of the individual emitters of that phased array have to have close to the same amount of power on exactly the same frequency with a predictable amount of phase shift on each one of those emitters. Now you can steer a beam. But when the other signals on the other antennas are on some other frequency, and the antennas have so little effective area, the fact that there are other antennas nearby, that is a very minor perturbation. With laboratory instrumentation, it would almost be difficult to measure the interference to the antenna pattern created by those other antennas. So with that thought in mind, and my experience with antenna testing laboratories led me to believe all of that. There could be an error to it, but it's what I strongly believe, and it's what I've seen in a lot of circumstances. I think you've got a rather ideal location for that antenna. So I don't think if there is a problem, it is a location problem. I don't think there is a more ideal location for that antenna other than the fact that there are other things nearby. And if you didn't have enough filtering, you could be getting some electromagnetic interference. But that would be because of overload of the front end, because the filter is not rejecting the adjacent signal. KE2EJ, K2LIW, over to you, Eric.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, sorry that I changed your orientation. I oriented it the way I'm used to seeing things in relation to the island, so I wanted to be sure I was pointing out the right places, because you can get confused without looking at the ground, but I wanted it to be zoomed in enough so you could see the top. But unfortunately, the resolution that you get at Google Earth, you can't actually see. reality what's actually up there, but, you know, there's been, let's put it this way, steel poles, almost equivalent in height of the antenna that have since been removed, that had a different type of antenna on the top of it. I told you there was a low-power TV station and a couple other things up there. That's all of that's gone. You know, I don't have any worry about it being in the center of the cluster. By the way, it's the antenna deployed in 4 feet from one another, but that doesn't bother me, really. So, I was the one that actually brought it up, you know, you and Andy. So, I just wanted to see that you got the response to the question that you asked me.
I sure did, Eric, and I thank you for the response. And you've got an arrow pointing toward the antenna, and above the actual antenna you've got this white vertical line. I am guessing that white vertical line that has no arrows on it, that is collinear to the antenna, telling me the location of the antenna within that bed spring of antennas. Is that approximately true, Eric? KQLIW?
Well, I didn't have the time. I was going to cut out a picture of the actual antenna and use that instead of the solid white line, but I was in a hurry.
You got the point across. And from your memory of seeing it up close, the nearest stick adjacent to the one we care about most, roughly how many feet away is that, Derek? That's just for academic reasons. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the antennas are mounted in rows, and some of them are a little, I think, I would guess that they're 2 feet apart. Maybe some of them are a little bit closer, but not by much.
Yeah, the free space loss of 2 feet on these frequencies is numbers like 20 dB. So, some pretty potent signals are coming into the antenna from adjacent sticks. But of course, those signals cannot get past the duplexing filter and probably other filters you've got. So as long as all the coax cable connectors are tight, that is a reasonably safe situation. Okay, I thank you for that. I think it's time, way beyond the time, we should be going over to the mailbag. KC2WGB, how many challenging letters did you get this week, John? KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2IW, and also tell us, what have you seen on Echolink tonight? You got it, John.
I think he's been here all night, Dick.
Okay. In which case, that's a little bit worrisome. We'll skip that for tonight, and we'll go straight over to the space report. And some astronauts came back. Some launches have been made. Maybe there's an analysis of what happened on Launch Pad 40. So tell us any about all of the above, Paul. WS2N with the space report. Number 218, I think it is. K2RIW. You got it, Paul.
This is WS2N. Yeah, that's right, 218. And first of all, I sent you a picture. I sent John one, too, of the electrical lighting grid around the launch complexes. I wonder if you saw that.
I sure did. That's a beautiful lightning arrestor. Four well-grounded towers set off in a square pattern around launch pad number 40, I think it is. From the top of each of the four towers, you've got wires that go toward the center. They in turn pick up another square of wire. It looked to me like that square of wire is about 100 feet on the side. So the rocket that's being launched is going to be launched through the center of a square hole of wire that's probably 400 feet in the air, suspended by these four towers. So for lightning to get past all of that stuff and strike our launch pad rocket is very difficult. Those towers and all those wires are going to pick up that lightning real fast. So until that launch takes place, it's very safe with that arrangement. WS2N, K2LIW, good looking picture of Paul, thank you.
Yeah, I have plenty of other pictures, but that was the best one because it was an Atlas taking off from Launch Complex. It was 41. That's the one that ULA, United Launch Alliance Group, which is really a partnership between Boeing and Lockheed. They launch all these rockets. They launch the Atlas. They launch the Deltas, the Delta Heavies, the Delta Fours. They use that pad in particular for the Atlas V launches. So that happened to be a launch of a Cygnus cargo spacecraft that was going up to the International Space Station back in March. But that was a good picture. Some of the other pictures you can see, you know, it's a blue sky, and if you look close, you can see the line going around if you look close on some pictures. But that one, because it was a night flight, really lit it up very well. And by the way, all those wires, let me drop it. Are made of stainless steel, and then they in turn go down to the ground, and then there's a grid completely all around the whole complex. They're all connected together, another big square at the bottom. The towers themselves are about 250 feet high, and then that white piece that goes up from the top of the tower up to the wire, that's an insulated device. It's partially it's fiberglass. It's like almost like a big fiberglass pipe, and that's about 150 feet high. So that gives you about 400-foot towers. And they've been building these, they built it around the shuttle launch complex in later years. The earlier shuttle complex just had one fiberglass piece going up from the top of the launch complex itself, and then wires running down to the ground that way. That was all changed. And now, if you look around the world, you know, China and India, they've all copied the same design to protect their equipment, which some people think, well, maybe this explosion on Launch Complex 40 with the Falcon 9. Had some kind of stray electrical anomaly through the air, but they say it's 100% secure, safe. And of course, on that day, it was blue sky when they were running that test. So it's probably, of course, nothing to do with that. But they are still looking for the problem. Elon Musk and SpaceX is still searching for what caused the explosion, or like we call the RUD, the rapid unscheduled disassembly of that. Not only the second stage, which it looks like it started in second, probably most, I'm thinking the oxygen tank again, second stage, and then that wound up knocking the payload from the top that was in the fairing. You could see that coming down, exploding on the ground, and of course it took out the whole first stage as well. And now they to clean up. Well, they're leaving things pretty much alone right now. They're investigating. They want to look at the pieces and try to find out what happened. And they are, going through all their data. I think I mentioned last week they're looking for like 35 milliseconds of data that they're looking at to see if they can find out what the problem is. But they needed, they need hazmat trained people to do a cleanup on this place because the fuel that they use for the rocket on the first and second stage is not a problem. That's RP-1, which is essentially a refined kerosene. The problem is the payload itself carries hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide to to operate their all their thrusters and everything. So that is very hazardous. So that's why. That's right. Broke windows. of the way. So we'll see how that goes. They're going to be really behind the eight ball for a while. It's going to take a while, I think, to straighten this mess out. We drop it. But in the meantime, United Launch Alliance is doing really quite well. Like you mentioned in the beginning of the net, you have the OSIRIS-REx mission, which took off. That was on the 8th of this month, a couple of days ago. And it successfully not only went into orbit, but it left the gravitational well and is safely on the way to Bennu, which is an asteroid they plan on visiting. They'll get there in about 2 years, actually about two Septembers from now. They'll go into orbit around Bennu. Bennu is about, I think it's around 1,500 feet, 500 meters in diameter. And they plan on going into orbit around it and looking at it intently for about 2 years. And then after that, send a craft down with an arm sticking out. It's called a TAG SAM. TAG stands for touch and go. And the TAG SAM is going to collect pieces from that asteroid and put it into another craft that's attached to it, which will be a descent module when it comes back to Earth. And that whole thing will take 7 years. It'll be coming back in 2023. And again, roughly September time, I think it was. It'll land in, it'll come in, you know, in through the atmosphere with parachutes and land in the Utah Army testing range. So it's going to come down in the state of Utah. You were talking about the acronym for OSIRIS-REx. It's interesting because I did watch the coverage of they had a news conference before this was all going to take off, you know, about 4 or 5 days before. Drop it. And they had the principal investigator on. Well, they had a lot of people on, but the main guy was this guy, Dr. Dante, and he's guys from that's been doing this for like the last 10 years, concentrating on this mission. Comes out of the University of Arizona, and he was talking about the meaning behind the OSIRIS-REx, and by the way, it stands for the Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer. And yes, I read that. I cannot memorize that. But what was pretty good was he broke it apart, and he tried to explain where they get all this from. And the first word, origins, he said was, really, where did all this stuff come from on the Earth? And that's what they want to explore. I believe that a lot of asteroids hit the Earth early on, and so they want to investigate that. And then spectral interpretation, the next word is for spectrographs and, spectroscopes on board. So they're going to investigate for a year or so, going around this asteroid, taking all kinds of measurements down to like the centimeter, some small resolution that they plan on using. And by doing that, they'll eventually know where they want to go down and pick stuff up and bring back. Then they have resource identification. And what they want to do there is get information. There are a lot of private companies. WS2N, there are a lot of companies that are planning on mining asteroids. Manufacturing things, bringing stuff back in the long run, many years from now, of getting water from it. There's a lot of, you know, actual private companies that are planning on launches in the very near future for preliminary tests, but they're going to help out, NASA's going to help out, try to give them some information. So that's where resource identification comes. Security, well, they're really talking about can the Earth be safe from impacts from asteroids like this? This is what's considered a near-Earth asteroid. So they'd like to know, you know, can things like the light affect the, you know, put, you know, regular life in the sun affect the asteroid to a point where it might change its orbit as time goes on. I think they call it the Yudkowsky effect or something like that. Begins with a Y. And this guy came up with this theory years ago that the light itself hitting an asteroid could change it a little bit and actually either push it one way or the other. And they're going to investigate that. And then the last thing is the regolithic flora. Let me drop it. Where this tag stamp thing is coming in. I call it touch and go because everybody pretty much calls it the tag, but it's a tag stamp. It's kind of a touch and go sample acquisition mechanism. But, you know, I'm happy with touch and go. It's an 11-foot arm that's going to be attached to this thing. With the nitrogen jets behind the, let's call it the hand, at the end of the arm. And as it goes down to the asteroid, this is after searching, using all their equipment, they have an 8-inch telescope on board for pictures. They're going to figure out where exactly they want to get material and bring back. And they'll go down and it's disc, it looks like about 12 inches in diameter. It's going to touch the surface and have nitrogen flow through it, forcing any material, loose material, up into the tag. And with that, they'll put it on board the spacecraft and eventually deorbit and come back to Earth and have this piece of equipment bring this sample back from an asteroid 7 years from now. And with that, the spacecraft itself will continue on and go into a heliocentric orbit. It'll be going around the sun forever. And they'll probably think of a mission extension for that thing. Let me drop it. So I thought that was pretty good. They're doing good. They have another launch coming up in a couple of weeks from California, and they plan on launching another. Actually, it's another Atlas V. They have a launch complex out there that the United Launch Alliance uses, so it'll be sending something up very shortly. And they have a few more launches planned before the end of the year. But SpaceX had, you know, at least 8 or 9 planned. I'm wondering if they're going to get to any to straighten out their problems. I know we talked about the Rosetta mission many times on the net, and that's the one that went out to that comet 67P, and they successfully went into orbit around it. Then they had a lander, lander, and went down to the comet, and it failed to attach itself to the comet. And kind of bounced around, and they lost it. It had batteries on board, so they got, I think, 50-some-odd hours out of it before the batteries failed. But they could never be sure of where it wound up on the comet. They needed to have that information, because some science information was sent back, but without knowing exactly where it was on the comet, it was making the science that it did get back not as useful as they would have liked it to have. But now, I think it's about a week or so before they were going to end the mission anyway. Sure enough, they located this thing with the mothership Rosetta that's going around the orbit of 67P, and they did actually visually picture it. It's kind of like stuck in a it. So that mission's coming to an end. Rosetta is, they're going to actually deorbit that and let it go down and land on a comet, and they're going to shut everything down. 100%, the antenna will no longer be pointing toward Earth, and that will be the end of the mission. So that's pretty much it. You know, I just I do have to mention we haven't heard from Virgin Galactic in a long time. They're planning a spacecraft with people that will eventually be going in there. A couple of years from now, I think probably 2018. I think they plan on a piloted test next year, and they have a spacecraft called Unity that has replaced the first one that unfortunately crashed and killed one of the pilots as that was being tested. But now they have this thing, they brought it out to the runway out in Edwards back in February, did some ground testing, you know, rolled it around on the tarmac. And this week they took it up on the White Knight 2, and the White Knight 2 is a carrier jet, and it's got a four jet engine attached to it. This spaceship 2, I guess they call it, named Unity, is attached to the middle of it, and eventually will be dropped and tested, you know, in flight, like the other one was being tested, a series of flights, until eventually they could make this safe enough where they can carry people to suborbital space just above the common line. That's pretty much it, Dick. There's always more, but, you know, I don't want to kill the net here. K2RIW, WS2N.
You don't want to kill the net. I'm not quite sure what that means, Paul Stablerian. I got a question for you. Those four grounded towers that operate as the lightning arrestor around launch pad 40, why is the top 150 of those 150 feet made out of fiberglass? You would think you want that to be grounded all the way, but maybe that fiberglass contains some kind of a resistor that's acting as a damping factor to absorb the lightning bolt, and the wires themselves, I'd like them to be grounded. But if the wires are connected to a fiberglass top of the tower, they have the ability to be insulated. Now, maybe there are separate wires going down to the ground, which maybe there's a set of relays where they could be grounded, or if you open those relays, you could measure the voltage on those wires and see if there's a local E field. So maybe that's why the top of those towers are fiberglass. I didn't realize that they're fiberglass, and I wonder if NASA made it clear as to why they did it that way, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I've read that it's a fiberglass type material. So, and I've seen a picture, was pretty close up, it's, I think it's about 3 feet in diameter. So they're pretty big. So basically, it's I understand, it's a big insulator. And you got the grid on top of stainless steel wires, and they, if you look, I don't know, you have to look at the picture. I wonder if that picture, I'll have to look it up again, shows that they have wires coming down on angles. They don't look like 45, it's probably 30-degree angles. They're coming down from the top of that tower, all kinds of wires. And then they attach the wires that are underneath the ground that run from, you know, the whole perimeter around this whole big square, actually underground, so. So the wires themselves are being insulated by this 150-foot insulated, I'll call it, insulated pipe at the top of the tower. The towers themselves, of course, are insulated, but that's another issue. These wires aren't tied to that tower before they get down to the ground. They come down to the ground first, and then they're all interconnected. That's what I've read. Back to there.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net time.
Almost anybody who puts up a radio tower like those four towers